They could hear more screams and yells now, and Gianetta called out a name. Manfredo! We'd better see what's going on, said Ezio, making his way down the street in the direction of the fracas. In the square, they found Cristina's friend Gianetta, another girl whom Ezio did not recognize, and an elderly man who, he remembered, had worked as Cristina's father's head clerk. What's going on? Said Ezio. It's Manfredo, cried Gianetta. Gambling debts again. This time they're going to kill him for sure. What? Cried Cristina. I'm so sorry, signorina, said the clerk. Two men to whom he owes money. They've dragged him off to the foot of the new bridge. They said they were going to beat the debt out of him. I'm so sorry, signorina. I could do nothing. That's all right, Sandeo. Go and call the house guards. I'd better go and... Wait a minute, put in Ezio. Who the devil is Manfredo? Cristina looked at him as if from the inner side of prison bars. My fidanzato, she said. Let me see what I can do, said Ezio, and rushed away down the street that led in the direction of the bridge. A minute later, he stood at the top of the embankment, looking down at the narrow strip of land near the first arch of the bridge, close to the heavy, slow-moving, yellow waters of the Arno. There, a young man clad in elegant black and silver was on his knees. Two more young men were sweating and grunting as they kicked him hard, or bent down to pummel him with their fists.
I'll pay it back, I swear, groaned the young man in black and silver.
We've had enough of your excuses, said one of his tormentors. You've made us look very foolish, so now we're going to make an example of you. And he raised his boot to the young man's neck, pushing him face down in the mud while his companion kicked him in the ribs. The first attacker was about to stamp on the young man's kidneys when he felt himself grabbed by the scruff of the neck and his coattails. Someone was lifting him high up, and the next thing he knew, he was flying through the air, landing seconds later in the water among the sewage and debris that had washed up around the foot of the first pier of the bridge. He was too busy choking on the disgusting water that had poured into his mouth to notice that his companion had by now suffered the same fate. Ezio reached a hand down to the mud-spattered young man and hauled him to his feet.
Grazie, signore. I think they really would have killed me this time, but they'd have been fools if they had. I could have paid them, honestly.
Aren't you afraid they'll come after you again?
Not now they think I've got a bodyguard like you.
I haven't introduced myself.
Ezio de Castronovo. Manfredo d'Arzenta, at your service.
I'm not your bodyguard, Manfredo.
It doesn't matter. You got those clowns off my back and I'm grateful. You don't know how much. In fact, you must let me reward you. But first, let me get cleaned up and take you for a drink. There's a little gaming house just off the Via Fiordaliso.
Now, just a minute, said Ezio, aware that Cristina and her companions were approaching.
What is it?
Do you do a lot of gambling?
Why not? It's the best way I know of passing the time.
Do you love her? Ezio cut in.
What do you mean?
Your fidanzata, Cristina. Do you love her? Manfredo looked alarmed at his rescuer's sudden vehemence.
Of course I do. If it's any of your business. Kill me here and I'd die, still loving her.
Ezio hesitated. It sounded as though the man was telling the truth. Then listen. You're never going to gamble again, do you hear?
Yes.
Manfredo was frightened.
Swear! I do.
You do not know how lucky a man you are. I want you to promise me to be a good husband to her. If I hear that you are not... I will hunt you down and kill you myself. Manfredo could see that his rescuer meant every word he had said. He looked into the cold grey eyes, and something in his memory stirred.
Do I not know you? He said. There's something about you. You seem familiar.
We have never met before, said Ezio. And we need never meet again unless... He broke off. Cristina was waiting at the end of the bridge, looking down. Go to her, and keep your promise.
I will.
Manfredo hesitated.
I really do love her, you know.
Perhaps I really have learned something today.
And I will do everything in my power to make her happy. I need no threat to my life to make me promise that.
I hope so,
Now go.
Ezio watched Manfredo climb the embankment for a moment, feeling his eyes irresistibly drawn to Christina's. Their gaze met for a moment, and he half raised a hand in farewell. Then he turned and walked away. Not since the deaths of his kinsmen had his heart been so heavy. Saturday evening found him still cast in deep gloom. At the darkest moments it seemed to him that he had lost everything. Father, brothers, home, status, career, and now wife. But then he reminded himself of the kindness and protection Mario had afforded him, and of his mother and sister, whom he had been able to save and protect. As for future and career, he still had both, except that they were running in a very different direction from that in which he had hitherto imagined they would run. He had a job to do, and no pining over Christina would help him finish it. It would be impossible for him ever to cut her out of his heart, but he would have to accept the lonely destiny fate had accorded him. Perhaps that was the way of the assassin. Perhaps that was what adherence to the creed involved. He made his way to the Mercato Vecchio in a somber mood. The district was shunned by most people he knew, and he himself had only once visited it before. The old market square was dingy and neglected, as were the buildings and streets that surrounded it. A number of people were passing to and fro, but this was no passeggiata. These people walked with a purpose, wasting no time, and kept their heads down. Ezio had taken care to dress simply, and had not worn a sword, though he had buckled on his new wristplate and his original spring-blade dagger too, in case of need. Still, he knew that he must stand out from the crowd around him, and he was on the alert. He was wondering what course to take next, and was thinking of going into a low alehouse on the corner of the square to see if he could find out, obliquely, by what means he could make contact with the fox, when a slim young man suddenly appeared from nowhere and jostled him. "Scusi, signore," said the young man politely, smiling, and moved swiftly past him. Instinctively, Ezio's hand went to his belt. His precious belongings he had left safely stowed at his lodgings, but he had brought a few florins with him in his belt purse, and now it was gone. He spun round to see the young man heading towards one of the narrow streets that led off the square, and gave chase. Seeing him, the thief doubled his pace, but Ezio managed to keep him in sight and ran after him, catching up with him at last and collaring him as he was about to enter a tall, nondescript tenement on Via Sant'Angelo. "Give it back," he snarled. "I don't know what you mean," retorted the thief, but his eyes were scared. Ezio, who had been on the point of releasing his dagger, reined in his anger. The man, it suddenly occurred to him, might be able to give him the information he sought. "I have no interest in hurting you, friend," he said. "Just give me back my purse and we'll say no more." After hesitating, "You win," said the young man, ruefully, reaching for the satchel at his side. "There's just one thing," Ezio said. The man was instantly wary. "What?" "Do you know where I might find a man who calls himself La Volpe?" Now the man looked seriously frightened. "Never heard of him. Here, take your money, signore, and let me go." "Not until you've told me." "Just a minute," said a deep, throaty voice behind him. "I may be able to help you." Ezio turned to see a broad-shouldered man of similar height to his own, but perhaps 10 or 15 years older than he was. Over his head he wore a hood not unlike Ezio's, which partly obscured his face, but under it Ezio could make out 2 piercing violet eyes which shone with a strange power, boring into him. "Please let my colleague go," said the man. "I'll answer for him." To the young thief he said, "Give the gentleman his money, Corradine, and make yourself scarce. We'll talk of this later." He spoke with such authority that Ezio released his grasp. In a second Corradine had placed Ezio's purse in his hand and vanished into the building. "Who are you?" Ezio asked. The man smiled slowly. "My name is Gilberto. But they call me many things, murderer, for example, and Tagliagole. But to my friends I'm simply known as the Fox." He bowed slightly, still holding Ezio with those penetrating eyes of his. "'And I am at your service, Messer Auditore. "'Indeed, I have been expecting you.
"'How do you know my name?
"'It is my business to know everything in this city. "'And I know, I think, why you believe I can help you.
"'My uncle gave me your name.' "'The fox smiled again, but said nothing.
"'I need to find someone, to be one step ahead of him as well, if I can.'
"'Who is it you seek?'
"'Francesco de Pazzi.'
"'Big game, I see.'
The fox looked serious.
"'It may be that I can help you.' He paused, considering. "'I've had word that some people from Rome recently disembarked at the docks. "'They're here to attend a meeting which no one else is supposed to know about. "'But they do not know about me, still less that I am the eyes and ears of this city. "'The host of this meeting is the man you want.'
When is it to take place?
Tonight. The fox smiled again. Don't worry, Ezio, it isn't fate. I would have sent someone to fetch you to me if you hadn't found me yourself. But it amused me to test you. Very few who seek me succeed.
You mean, you set me up with Corradine?
Forgive me my sense of the theatrical, but I also had to be sure you were not followed. He's a young man, and it was also a kind of test for him. You see, I may have set you up with him, but he had no real idea of the service he was doing me. He just thought I'd singled out a victim for him.
His tone became harder, more practical.
Now, you must find a way to spy on this meeting, but it won't be easy.
He looked at the sky.
It is sunset. We must hurry, and the quickest way is over the rooftops. Follow me.
Without another word, he turned and scaled the wall behind him at such a speed that Ezio was hard put to keep up. They raced over the red-tiled roofs, leaping the chasms of the streets in the last afterglow of the sun, silent as cats, soft-footed as running foxes, heading northwest across the city, until they arrived in sight of the facade of the great church of Santa Maria Novella. Here the fox came to a halt. Ezio had caught him up in seconds, but he noticed that he was more breathless than the older man.
"You've had a good teacher," said the fox.
But Ezio had the distinct impression that if he had so chosen, his new friend could have outrun him with ease. And that increased his determination to hone his skills further. But now wasn't the time for contests or games.
"That is where Messer Francesco is holding his meeting," said the fox, pointing downwards.
"In the church?"
"Under it. Come on."
At that hour, the piazza in front of the church was all but deserted. The fox leapt down from the roof they were on, landing gracefully in a crouch, and Ezio followed suit. They skirted the square and the side of the church until they came to a postern gate set into its wall. The fox ushered Ezio through it, and they found themselves in the Rucellai chapel. Near the bronze tomb at its centre, the fox paused.
"There is a network of catacombs which crisscross the city far and wide. I find them very useful in my line of work, but unfortunately they're not exclusive to me. Not many know about them, however, or how to find their way about in them. But Francesco de Pazzi is one. It is down there that he's holding his meeting with the people from Rome. This is the closest entrance to where they will be, but you'll have to make your own way to them. And there's a chapel, part of an abandoned crypt, 50 yards to your right once you've descended, and be very careful, for sound travels very acutely down there. It will be dark, too, so allow your vision to become accustomed to the gloom. Soon you'll be guided by the lights in the chapel."
He placed his hand over a stone boss on the pedestal that supported the tomb, and pressed it. At his feet, an apparently solid flagstone swung down on invisible hinges to reveal a flight of stone steps. He stood aside.
"Buona fortuna, Ezio."
"You're not coming?"
"It is not necessary. And even with all my skills, two people make more noise than one. I'll wait for you here. Va, go."
Once below ground, Ezio groped his way along the damp stone corridor that ran away to his right. He was able to feel his way along, for the walls were close enough here for him to touch either side with each hand, and he was relieved that his feet made no sound on the wet, earthen floor. Occasionally, other tunnels branched off, and he could feel them rather than see them as his guiding hands touched nothing but a black void. Getting lost down here would be a nightmare, for one would never find one's way out again.
Little sounds startled him at first, until he realized that they were nothing but the scuttling of rats, though once, when one ran over his feet, he could barely stifle a cry. In niches carved into the walls, he caught glimpses of the corpses from time-worn burials, their skulls shrouded in cobwebs. There was something primordial and terrifying about the catacombs, and Ezio had to bite back a rising sense of panic. At last he saw a dim light ahead, and moving more slowly now, advanced towards it. He stayed in the shadows as he came within earshot of the five men he could see ahead, silhouetted in the lamplight of a cramped and very ancient chapel. He recognized Francesco immediately, a small, wiry, intense creature who, as Ezio arrived, was bowed before two tonsured priests he did not recognize. The older of the two was giving the blessing in a clear, nasal voice.
Et benedictio Dei omnipotentis, Patris et Filii et Spiritus Sancti, descendat super vos et maneat semper.
As his face caught the light, Ezio recognized him. He was Stefano da Bagnoni, secretary to Francesco's uncle Jacopo. Jacopo himself stood near him.
"Thank you, Padre," said Francesco when the blessing was concluded.
He straightened himself and addressed a fourth man who was standing beside the priests.
"Bernardo, give us your report."
"Everything is in readiness. We have a full armory of swords, staves, axes, bows and crossbows."
"A simple dagger would be best for the job," put in the younger of the two priests.
"It depends on the circumstances, Antonio," said Francesco.
"Or poison," continued the younger priest. "But it doesn't matter, as long as he dies. I will not easily forgive him for bringing down Volterra, my birthplace and my only true home."
"Calm yourself," said the man called Bernardo. "We all have motive enough. Now, thanks to Pope Sixtus, we also have the means."
"Indeed, Messer Baroncelli," replied Antonio. "But do we have his blessing?" A voice came from the deep shadows beneath the lamplight at the rear of the chapel.
"He gives his blessing to our operation, provided that nobody is killed."
The owner of the voice emerged into the lamplight, and Ezio drew in his breath as he recognized the cowled figure in crimson, though all of his face but the sneer on his lips was covered by the shadow of his hood. So this was the principal visitor from Rome, Rodrigo Borgia, il Spagnolo. The conspirators all shared his knowing smile. They all knew where the Pope's loyalty lay, and that it was the cardinal who stood before them who controlled him. But naturally, the Supreme Pontiff could not openly condone the spilling of blood.
"It's good that the job can be done at last," said Francesco. "We've had enough setbacks. As it is, killing them in the cathedral will draw heavy criticism on us."
"It is our last and only option," said Rodrigo with authority. "And as we are doing God's work in ridding Florence of such scum, the setting is appropriate. Besides, once we control the city, let the people murmur against us, if they dare." "Still, they keep changing their plans," said Bernardo Baroncelli. "I'm even going to have someone call on his younger brother Giuliano to make sure he's up in time for High Mass." All the men laughed at that, except Jacopo and the Spaniard, who had noticed his sober expression. "What is it, Jacopo?" Rodrigo asked the older Pazzi. "Do you think they suspect something?" Before Jacopo could speak, his nephew waded in impatiently.
"It's impossible. The Medici are too arrogant or too stupid even to notice."
"Do not underestimate our enemies," Jacopo chided him. "Don't you see that it was Medici money that funded the campaign against us at San Gimignano?"
"There will be no such problems this time," snarled his nephew, bridling at having been corrected in front of his peers, and with the memory of his son Vieri's death still green in his mind.
In the silence that followed, Bernardo turned to Stefano de Bagnoni.
"I'll need to borrow a set of your priestly robes for tomorrow morning, Padre. The more they think they're surrounded by clerics, the safer they'll feel."
"Who will strike?" asked Rodrigo.
"I,"
said Francesco. And I, chimed in Stefano, Antonio, and Bernardo.
Good, Rodrigo paused. I think on the whole daggers would be best. So much easier to conceal, and very handy when close work is involved. But it's still good to have the Pope's armory as well. I don't doubt but there'll be a few loose ends to clear up once the Medici brothers are no more.
He raised his hand and made the sign of the cross over his fellow conspirators.
Dominus vobiscum, gentlemen, he said, and may the Father of Understanding guide us.
He looked around.
Well, I think that concludes our business. You must forgive me if I take my leave of you now. There are several things I need to do before I return to Rome, and I must be on my way before dawn. It wouldn't do at all for me to be seen in Florence on the day the House of Medici crumbled to dust.
Ezio waited, pressed against a wall in the shadows until the six men had departed, leaving him in darkness. Only when he was quite sure that he was fully alone did he produce his own lamp and strike a tinder to its wick. He made his way back the way he had come. The fox was waiting in the shadowy Rucellai chapel. Ezio, with a full heart, told him what he had heard.
"To murder Lorenzo and Giuliano de' Medici in the cathedral at high mass tomorrow morning," said the fox when Ezio had finished.
And Ezio could see that for once the man was almost at a loss for words.
"It is sacrilege.
And it is worse than that. If Florence should fall to the Pazzi, then God help us all."
Ezio was lost in thought. "Can you get me a seat in the cathedral tomorrow?" he asked. "Close to the altar, near the Medici." The fox looked grave.
"Hard, but perhaps not impossible."
He looked at the young man.
"I know what you're thinking, Ezio, but this is something you cannot possibly pull off alone."
"I can try, and I have the element of surprise. And more than one stranger's face among the aristocrazia near the front might arouse the Pazzi's suspicions.
But you must get me in there, Gilberto."
"Call me the fox," Gilberto answered him. Then, grinning, "Only foxes can match me for cunning."
He paused.
"Meet me in front of the Duomo 30 minutes before high mass."
He looked Ezio in the eye with new respect.
"I will help if I can, Messer Ezio. Your father would have been proud of you."
Chapter 9. Ezio arose before dawn the following day, Sunday, 26th of April, and made his way to the cathedral. Very few people were about, though a handful of monks and nuns were making their way to perform the rite of Lourdes. Aware that he should avoid notice, he climbed arduously to the very top of the campanile and watched the sun rise over the city. Gradually beneath him, the square began to fill with citizens of every description, families and couples, merchants and nobles, eager to attend the main service of the day, graced as it would be by the presence of the Duke and his younger brother and co-ruler. Ezio surveyed the people keenly, and when he saw the fox arrive on the cathedral steps, he made his way to the side of the tower least in view and clambered down, agile as a monkey, to join him, remembering to keep his head low and to blend in as far as was possible with the crowd, using his fellow citizens as cover. He had put on his best clothes for the occasion and wore no weapon openly, though many of his male fellow citizens of the wealthy merchant and banking class had ceremonial swords at their waistbands. He could not resist keeping an eye out for Christina, but he did not see her.
"Here you are," said the fox, as Ezio joined him. "All the arrangements have been made, and a place reserved for you on the aisle in the third row."
As he spoke, the crowd on the steps parted, and a row of heralds raised trumpets to their lips and blew a fanfare.
"They're coming," he added.
Entering the square from the baptistry side, Lorenzo de' Medici appeared first with his wife Clarice at his side. She held little Lucrezia, their oldest, by the hand, and five-year-old Piero marched proudly on his father's right. Behind them, accompanied by her nurse, came three-year-old Maddalena, while baby Leo,
swaddled in white satin, was carried by his. They were followed by Giuliano and his heavily pregnant mistress, Fioretta. The mass of people in the square bowed low as they passed, to be met at the entrance to the Duomo by two of the attendant priests, whom Ezio recognized with a thrill of horror, Stefano da Bagnoni and the one from Volterra, whose full name, as the fox told him, was Antonio Maffei. The Medici family entered the cathedral, followed by the priests, and they were followed by the citizens of Florence in order of rank. The fox nudged Ezio and pointed. Among the throng he had spotted Francesco de Pazzi and his fellow conspirator, Bernardo Baroncelli, disguised as a deacon. "Go now," he hissed urgently to Ezio. "Keep close to them." More and more people crowded into the cathedral until it could hold no more, so that those who had hoped for a place had to be content to remain outside. 10,000 people had gathered in all, and the fox had never seen such a great assembly in Florence in all his life. He prayed silently for Ezio's success. Inside, the crowd settled in the stifling heat. Ezio had not been able to get as close to Francesco and the others as he had wished, but kept them under close eye, calculating what he would have to do to reach them as soon as they started their attack. The Bishop of Florence, meanwhile, had taken his place before the high altar, and the mass began. It was at the point when the bishop was blessing the bread and wine that Ezio noticed Francesco and Bernardo exchange glances. The Medici family was seated just in front of them. At the same moment, the priests Bagnone and Maffei, on the lower steps of the altar, and closest to Lorenzo and Giuliano, looked round surreptitiously. The bishop turned to face the congregation, raised aloft the golden goblet, and started to speak. "The blood of Christ!" Then everything happened at once. Baroncelli sprang to his feet with a cry of "Creappa traditore!" and plunged a dagger into Giuliano's neck from behind. A fountain of blood spewed from the wound, showering Fioretta, who fell screaming to her knees. "Let me finish the bastard," yelled Francesco, elbowing Baroncelli aside and throwing Giuliano, who was trying to staunch his wound with his hands, to the floor. Francesco knelt astride him and plunged his dagger over and over again into his victim's body, in such a frenzy that once, without seeming to notice, he drove his weapon into his own thigh. Giuliano was long dead before Francesco had struck him the 19th and last blow. Meanwhile, Lorenzo, with a cry of alarm, had spun round to face his brother's attackers, while Clarice and the nurses bundled the children and Fioretta to safety. There was confusion everywhere. Lorenzo had spurned the idea of having his bodyguards close. A murderous attack in a church was a thing all but unheard of. But now they struggled to reach him through the mass of confused and panic-stricken worshippers, jostling and trampling each other in order to get away from the scene of butchery. But the situation was made far worse by the heat, and the fact that there was scarcely any room to move at all, except for the area immediately in front of the altar. The bishop and his attendant priests stood aghast, rooted to the spot, but Bagnone and Maffei, seeing Lorenzo's back turned to them, seized their opportunity, and, drawing daggers from their robes, fell on him from behind. Priests are rarely experienced killers, and however noble they believed their cause to be, the two managed only to give Lorenzo flesh wounds before he shook them off. But in the struggle, they got the better of him again, and now Francesco, limping from his self-inflicted wound, but empowered by all the hatred that was boiling within him, was closing in too, roaring imprecations as he came, raising his dagger. Bagnone and Maffei, unmanned by what they had done, turned and fled in the direction of the apse. But Lorenzo was staggering, blood pouring from him, and a cut high on the right shoulder had made his sword arm useless. "Your day is done, Lorenzo," Francesco screamed. "Your entire misbegotten family dies by my sword." "Infame," returned Lorenzo. "I'll kill you now." "With that arm," sneered Francesco, and raised his dagger to strike. As his fist plunged down, a strong hand caught his wrist and arrested its motion before flinging him round. Francesco found himself looking into the face of another sworn enemy.
Benedictio, he growled. You, here. It's your day that is done, Francesco. The crowd was clearing, and Lorenzo's guards were pushing closer. Baroncelli had arrived at Francesco's side. Come, we must fly. It's over, he shouted.
I'll deal with these curs first, said Francesco, but his face was drawn.
His own wound was bleeding hard.
No, we must retreat.
Francesco looked furious, but there was agreement in his face.
This isn't over, he told Ezio.
No, it isn't. Wherever you go, I will follow, Francesco, until I have cut you down. Glaring, Francesco turned and followed Baroncelli, who was already vanishing behind the high altar. There had to be a door out of the cathedral in the apse. Ezio prepared to follow.
Wait,
a broken voice behind him said. Let them go. They won't get far.
I need you here. I need your help.
Ezio turned to see the Duke sprawled on the ground between two overturned chairs. Not far away, his family huddled and wept. Clarice, a look of horror on her face, embracing her two oldest children tightly. Fioretta was staring dully in the direction of Giuliano's twisted and mangled corpse. Lorenzo's guards had arrived.
Look after my family, he told them. The city will be in uproar over this. Get them to the palazzo and bar the doors.
He turned to Ezio.
You saved my life.
I did my duty. Now the Pazzi must pay the full price. Ezio helped Lorenzo up and placed him gently on a chair. Looking up, he saw that the bishop and the other priests were nowhere to be seen. Behind him, people were still pushing and shoving, clawing at each other to get out of the cathedral by the main western doors.
I must go after Francesco, he said.
No, said Lorenzo. I can't make it to safety on my own. You must help me.
Get me to San Lorenzo. I have friends there.
Ezio was torn, but he knew how much Lorenzo had done for his own family. He could not blame him for failing to prevent the deaths of his kinsmen, for how could anyone have predicted the suddenness of that attack? And now Lorenzo himself was the victim. He was still alive, too, but he would not be for long unless Ezio could get him to the nearest place where he could be treated. The Church of San Lorenzo was only a short distance northwest of the baptistry. He bound Lorenzo's wounds as best he could, with strips torn from his own shirt. Then he lifted him gently to his feet. Put your left arm round my shoulder. Good. Now there must be a way out beyond the altar. They hobbled in the direction their assailants had taken, and soon came to a small open door with bloodstains on its threshold. This was no doubt the way Francesco had gone. Might he be lying in wait? It would be hard for Ezio to release his springblade dagger, still less fight, while supporting Lorenzo on his right side. But he had his metal bracer strapped to his left forearm. They made their way into the square outside the north wall of the cathedral, and were greeted with scenes of confusion and chaos. They made their way west along the side of the cathedral, after Ezio had paused to wrap his cape over Lorenzo's shoulders in a makeshift attempt to disguise him. In the piazza between the cathedral and the baptistry, groups of men wearing the liveries of the Pazzi and the Medici were engaged in hand-to-hand combat, so engrossed that Ezio was able to slink past them. But as they reached the street that led up to the Piazza San Lorenzo, they were confronted by two men wearing the dolphin and crosses insignia. Both carried ugly-looking falchions.
Halt! One of the guards said. Where do you think you're going?
I must get this man to safety, said Ezio.
And who might you be? Said the second guard, unpleasantly. He came forward and peered at Lorenzo's face. Lorenzo, half fainting, turned away, but as he did so the cape slipped, revealing the Medici crest on his doublet.
Oho, said the second guard, turning to his friend. Looks like we might have caught a very big fish here, Terzago.
Ezio's brain raced. He couldn't let go of Lorenzo, who was still losing blood, but if he didn't, he couldn't use his weapon. He raised his left foot quickly and gave the guard a shove in the arse. He fell, sprawling. In seconds, his mate came for them, falchion raised. As the blade came down, Ezio parried and, using his wrist guard, deflected the blow. As he did so, he swung his left arm, forcing the sword away, cutting at the man with the double-bladed dagger attached to the wrist guard, though he could not get enough purchase to kill the man with it. And now the second guard was on his feet again, coming to the aid of his comrade, who in turn had staggered back, surprised that he had not cut Ezio's forearm off. Ezio stopped the second blade in the same way, but this time he managed to run the wrist guard down the cutting edge of the sword until it hit the hilt, bringing his hand in range of the man's wrist. He seized and twisted it so rapidly and hard that the man let go of his weapon with a sharp cry of pain. Stooping quickly, Ezio grabbed the falchion almost before it had hit the ground. It was hard, working with his left hand and encumbered by Lorenzo's weight, but he slashed it round and cut halfway through the guard's neck before he could recover. The second guard was coming at him again now, bellowing with anger. Ezio parried with his falchion, and he and the guard cut and thrust at each other several times. But the guard, unaware still of the concealed metal bracer on Ezio's left arm, aimed blow after useless blow at it. Ezio's arm ached, and he could barely keep on his feet, but at last he saw an opportunity. The man's helmet had worked loose, but the man was unaware of this, and was looking down at Ezio's forearm, preparing to aim another blow at it. Swiftly, Ezio flicked his own blade up, feinting as though he had missed, but actually he succeeded in knocking the helmet off the man's head. Then, before he could react, Ezio slammed the heavy falchion down on the man's skull and split it in two. The falchion stuck there, and Ezio was unable to work it loose. The man stood stock still for a moment, his eyes still wide with surprise, before crumpling to the dust. Looking quickly around, Ezio hauled Lorenzo up the street. "Not much farther, Altezza." They reached the church without further annoyance, but the doors were firmly shut against them. Ezio, looking back, saw at the end of the street that the bodies of the guards he'd killed had been discovered by a group of their comrades, who were now looking in their direction. He hammered on the doors, and a spy hole opened in it, revealing an eye and part of a suspicious face. "Lorenzo's been wounded," Ezio gasped. "They're coming for us. Open the door." "I need the password," said the man within. Ezio was at a loss, but Lorenzo had heard the sound of the man's voice, and, recognizing it, he rallied. "Angelo," he said loudly, "it's Lorenzo. Open the fucking door." "By the thrice greatest," said the man within, "we thought you must be dead." He turned and yelled at someone unseen. "Get this thing unbolted, and fast." The spy hole closed, and there was a sound of bolts quickly being drawn. Meanwhile, the patsy guardsmen, making their way up the street, had broken into a run. Just in time, one of the heavy doors swung open to admit Ezio and Lorenzo, and as quickly slammed shut behind them. The bolts shot back into place by the keepers in charge of them. There was a terrible noise of battle outside. Ezio found himself looking into the calm green eyes of a refined man of perhaps 24. "Angelo Poliziano," the man introduced himself. "I sent some of our men round the back way to intercept those patsy rats. They shouldn't give us any more trouble." Ezio Auditore. "Ah, Lorenzo has spoken of you," he interrupted himself. "But we can talk later. Let me help you get him to a bench. We can take a look at his wounds there." "He's safe now," said Ezio, handing Lorenzo over to two attendants who gently guided him to a bench set against the north wall of the church. "We'll patch him up, staunch the blood, and as soon as he's recovered enough, we'll get him back to his palazzo. Don't worry, Ezio. He is indeed safe now, and we will not forget what you have done." But Ezio was already thinking of Francesco de Pazzi. The man had had more than enough time to make good his escape. "I must take my leave," he said. "Wait," Lorenzo called. Nodding to Poliziano, Ezio went over to him and knelt by his side. "I am in your debt, signore," Lorenzo said. "And I do not know why you helped me, or how you could have known what was afoot when even my own spies could not." He paused, his eyes wrinkling in pain as one of the attendants cleaned his shoulder wound. "Who are you?" he continued when he had recovered a little. "He's Ezio Auditore," said Poliziano, coming up and placing a hand on Ezio's shoulder. Ezio, Lorenzo gazed at him, deeply moved. Your father was a great man and a good friend. He was one of my strongest allies. He understood honour, loyalty, and never put his own interests before those of Florence. But, he paused again and smiled faintly, I was there when Alberti died. Was it you?
Yes.
You took a fitting and swift revenge. As you see, I have not been so successful. But now, through their overweening ambition, the Pazzi have at last cut their own throats. I pray that— One of the men from the Medici patrol that had been sent out to deal with Ezio's Pazzi pursuers came hurrying up, his face streaked with blood and sweat.
What is it?
Asked Poliziano.
Bad news, sir. The Pazzi have rallied and they're storming the Palazzo Vecchio. We can't hold them off much longer.
Poliziano grew pale.
This is bad news indeed. If they gain control of it, they'll kill all the supporters we have that they can lay their hands on, and if they seize power...
If they seize power, Lorenzo said, my survival will mean nothing.
We will all be dead men.
He tried to get up, but fell back, groaning in pain.
Angelo, you must take what troops we have here and...
No, my place is with you. We must get you to the Palazzo Medici as soon as possible. From there we may be able to reorganize and hit back.
I will go, said Ezio. I have unfinished business with Messer Francesco as it is.
Lorenzo looked at him.
You have done enough.
Not until this job is finished, Altezza. And Angelo is right. He has a more important task to perform, getting you to the safety of your palazzo.
Signori, the Medici messenger put in, I have more news. I saw Francesco de Pazzi leading a troop to the rear of the Palazzo Vecchio. He's seeking a way in on the Signoria's blind side.
Poliziano looked at Ezio.
Go, arm yourself and take a detachment from here, and hurry. This man will go with you and be your guide. He will show you where it is safest to leave this church. From there, it will take you 10 minutes to reach the Palazzo Vecchio.
Ezio bowed and turned to leave.
Florence will never forget what you are doing for her, said Lorenzo.
Go with God.
Outside, the bells of most of the churches were ringing, adding to the cacophony of clashing steel and of human cries and groans. The city was in turmoil. Wagons set afire, blazed in the streets, pockets of soldiery from both sides ran hither and yon, or faced each other in pitched melees. The dead were scattered everywhere, in the squares and along the roadways, but there was too much tumult for the crows to dare to fly in for the feast they regarded with their harsh black eyes from the rooftops. The western doors of the Palazzo Vecchio stood open, and the noise of fighting came from the courtyard within. Ezio brought his little troop to a halt and accosted a Medici officer who was running towards the palazzo in charge of another squad.
Do you know what's going on?
The Pazzi broke in from the rear and opened the doors from within, but our men inside the palazzo are keeping them off. They haven't got beyond the courtyard. With luck, we'll be able to hem them in.
Is there news of Francesco de Pazzi?
He and his men are holding the back entrance of the palazzo. If we could gain control of that, we'd have them trapped for sure.
Ezio turned to his men.
Let's go, he shouted.
They rushed across the square and down the narrow street which ran along the north wall of the palazzo, where a very different Ezio had climbed to his father's cell window long ago, and taking the first right from it, quickly encountered the Pazzi troop under Francesco guarding the rear entrance. They were immediately on their guard, and when Francesco recognized Ezio, he cried,
You again? Why aren't you dead yet? You murdered my son.
He tried to murder me.
Kill him! Kill him now!
The two sides engaged fiercely, hacking and cutting at each other in near desperate fury, for the Pazzi knew full well how important it was to protect their line of retreat. Ezio, cold rage in his heart, muscled his way towards Francesco, who took a stand with his back to the palazzo door. The sword Ezio had taken from the Medici armory was well balanced and its blade was of Toledo steel, but the weapon was unfamiliar to him and, as a consequence, his blows were a fraction less effective than he'd normally inflict.
He had maimed rather than killed the men who had stood in his way. This Francesco had noticed.
"You think yourself a master swordsman now, do you, boy? You can't even make a clean kill. Let me give you a demonstration."
They fell on each other then, sparks flying from their blades as they clashed. But Francesco had less room to manoeuvre than Ezio, and, 20 years his senior, was beginning to tire, even though he had seen less action that day than his opponent.
"Guards!" he cried at last. "To me!"
But his men had fallen back before the Medici onslaught. He and Ezio now faced each other alone. Francesco looked desperately around for a means of retreat himself, but there was none save through the palazzo itself. He threw open the door behind him and went up a stone staircase that ran up the inside wall. Ezio realized that as most of the Medici defenders would be concentrated at the front of the building where most of the fighting was, they probably didn't have enough men to cover the rear as well. Ezio raced up after him to the second floor. The rooms here were deserted, since all the occupants of the palazzo, save for half a dozen frightened clerks who ran away as soon as they saw them, were down below, fighting to contain the Pazzi in the courtyard. Francesco and Ezio fought their way through the gilded, high-ceilinged state rooms until they reached a balcony high above the Piazza della Signoria. The noise of battle reached up to them from below, and Francesco called out hopelessly for aid, but there was no one to hear him, and his last retreat was cut off.
"Stand and fight," said Ezio. "It's just us now." "Maledetto!"
Ezio slashed at him, drawing blood from his left arm.
"Come on, Francesco. Where's all the courage you showed when you had my father killed? When you stabbed Giuliano this morning?" "Get the hell away from me, you spawn of the devil!"
Francesco lunged, but he was tiring, and his aim went far too wide. He staggered forwards, his balance thrown, and Ezio stood deftly aside, raising his foot and bringing it firmly down on Francesco's sword blade, pulling the man down with it. Before Francesco could recover, Ezio stamped on his hand, making him let go of the hilt, grabbed him by the shoulder, and heaved him over onto his back. As he struggled to get up, Ezio kicked him brutally in the face. Francesco's eyes rolled as he struggled into unconsciousness. Ezio knelt down and proceeded to frisk the old man while he was half awake, ripping off body armor and his doublet, revealing the pale, wiry body beneath. But there were no documents, nothing of importance on him. Just a handful of florins in his purse. Ezio flung aside his sword and released his spring-blade dagger. He knelt, put an arm under Francesco's neck, and pulled him up so that their faces were almost touching. Francesco's eyelids flickered open. His eyes expressed horror and fear.
"Spare me," he managed to croak.
At that moment, a great cry of victory rose from the courtyard below. Ezio listened to the voices, and caught enough to understand that the Pazzi had been routed.
"Spare you," he said. "I'd as soon spare a rabid wolf."
"No,"
shrieked Francesco.
"I beg you."
"This is for my father," said Ezio, stabbing him in the gizzard. "And this is for Federico," stabbing him again. "And this for Petruccio, and this for Giuliano."
Blood spurted and streamed from Francesco's wounds, and Ezio was covered in it. But he would have gone on stabbing the dying man if Mario's words had not then come back to him.
"Do not become the man he was."
He sank back onto his heels. Francesco's eyes still glittered, though their light was fading. He was muttering something. Ezio leaned low to listen.
"A priest. A priest. Oh, for pity's sake, fetch me a priest."
Ezio was deeply shocked, now that the fury within him had abated, at the savagery with which he had killed. This was not in accordance with the creed. "There is no time," he said. "I will have a mass said for your soul." Francesco's throat was rattling now. Then his limbs stiffened and shook as he reached his death throes, his head arching back, his mouth open wide as he fought the last impossible battle with the invincible foe, whom we all have to face one day. And he sank down, an empty bag,
a slight, shrunken, pallid thing.
"Requiescat in pace," murmured Ezio.
Then a new roar arose from the square. Across from the southwest corner, 50 or 60 men came running, led by a man Ezio recognized, Francesco's uncle, Jacopo. They bore the Pazzi banner aloft.
"Libertà! Libertà! Popolo e libertà!" they shouted as they came.
At the same time, the Medici forces streamed out of the palazzo to meet them, but they were tired and, as Ezio could see, outnumbered. He turned back to the body.
"Well, Francesco," he said, "I think I have found one way in which you can repay your debt, even now."
Quickly, he reached under the corpse's shoulders, hoisted it up, it was surprisingly light, and carried it to the balcony. Here, finding a lanyard from which a banner hung, he used the length of rope to fasten around the old man's lifeless neck. He quickly attached the other end to a sturdy stone column, and summoning up all his strength, raised it high, then tossed it over the parapet. The rope paid out, but suddenly jerked taut with a snap. Francesco's limp body hung, toes pointing listlessly at the ground far below. Ezio hid himself behind the column.
"Jacopo!" he called in a voice of thunder. "Jacopo de Pazzi! Look! Your leader is dead! Your cause is finished!"
Below he could see Jacopo look up and falter. Behind him his men, too, hesitated. The Medici troops had followed his gaze, and now, cheering, they were closing in. But the Pazzi had already broken ranks, and were fleeing. In a matter of days it was all over. The power of the Pazzi in Florence was broken. Their goods and property were seized, their coats of arms torn down and trampled. Despite Lorenzo's appeals for mercy, the Florentine mob hunted down and killed every Pazzi sympathizer they could find, though some of the principals had fled. Only one who was captured obtained clemency, Raffaele Riario, a nephew of the Pope, whom Lorenzo considered to be too credulous and ingenuous to have had any serious involvement, though many of the Duke's advisers thought that Lorenzo was showing more humanity than political astuteness in his decision. Sixtus IV was furious nevertheless, and placed Florence under an interdict, but he was powerless otherwise, and the Florentines shrugged him off. As for Ezio, he was one of the first to be summoned to the Duke's presence. He found Lorenzo standing on a balcony overlooking the Arno, watching the water. His wounds were still bandaged, but they were healing, and the pallor had left his cheeks. He stood proud and tall, and fully the man who had earned the sobriquet Florence had bestowed on him, Il Magnifico. After they had greeted one another, Lorenzo gestured towards the river. "Do you know, Ezio, when I was 6 years old, I fell into the Arno. I soon found myself drifting down and into darkness, certain that my life was at an end. Instead, I woke to the sound of my mother weeping. At her side stood a stranger, soaking wet and smiling. She explained to me that he had saved my life. That stranger's name was Auditore, and so began a long and prosperous relationship between our two families." He turned to look at Ezio solemnly. "I am sorry that I could not save your kinsman." Ezio found it hard to find words. The cold world of politics, where distinctions between right and wrong are too often blurred, was one he understood but rejected. "I know you would have saved them if it had been within your power," he said. "Your family house, at least, is safe and under the city's protection. I have put your old housekeeper, Annetta, in charge of it, and it is staffed and guarded at my expense. Whatever happens, it will be waiting for you whenever you wish to return to it."
"You are gracious, Altezza." Ezio paused. He was thinking of Christina. Might it not be too late to persuade her to break her engagement, marry him, and help him bring the Auditore family back to life? But 2 short years had changed him beyond recognition, and he had another duty now. a duty to the creed. "We have won a great victory," he said at last. "But the war is not won. Many of our enemies have escaped. But the safety of Florence is assured. Pope Sixtus wanted to persuade Naples to move against us, but I have persuaded Ferdinando not to do so, and neither will Bologna or Milan." Ezio could not tell the Duke of the greater battle he was engaged in, for he could not be sure if Lorenzo was privy to the secrets of the assassins. "For the sake of our greater security," he said, "I need your permission to go and seek out Jacopo de Pazzi." A cloud crossed Lorenzo's face. "That coward," he said angrily. "He fled before we could lay hands on him." "Do we have any idea where he might have gone?" Lorenzo shook his head. "No. They've hidden themselves well. My spies report that Baroncelli may be trying to make his way to Constantinople. But as for the others..." Ezio said, "Give me their names." And there was something in the firmness of his voice that told Lorenzo that here was a man it might be fatal to cross. "How could I ever forget the names of my brother's murderers? And if you seek and find them, I shall be forever in your debt. They are the priests Antonio Maffei and Stefano da Bagnoni. Bernardo Baroncelli I have mentioned. And there is another, not directly involved in the killings, but a dangerous ally of our enemies. He is the Archbishop of Pisa, Francesco Salviati, another of the Riario family, the Pope's hunting dogs. I showed his cousin clemency. I try not to be a man like they are. I wonder sometimes how wise I am in that." "I have a list," said Ezio. "Their names will be added to it." He prepared to take his leave. "Where will you go now?" asked Lorenzo. "Back to my Uncle Mario in Monteriggioni. That will be my base." "Then go with God, friend Ezio. But before you do, I have something that may interest you." Lorenzo opened a leather wallet at his belt, and from it extracted a sheet of vellum. Almost before he'd unrolled it, Ezio knew what it was. "I remember years ago talking to your father about ancient documents," said Lorenzo quietly. "It was a shared interest that we had. I know he'd translated some. Here, take this. I found it among Francesco de Pazzi's papers, and as he no longer needs it, I thought you might like it, as it reminded me of your father. Perhaps you might like to add it to his collection?" "I am indeed grateful for this, Altezza." "I thought you might be," said Lorenzo, in such a way as to make Ezio wonder how much he actually knew. "I hope you find it useful." Before he packed and made ready for his journey, Ezio hastened, with the fresh codex page Lorenzo had given him, to visit his friend Leonardo da Vinci. Despite the events of the last week, the workshop was carrying on as if nothing had happened. "I'm glad to see you safe and sound, Ezio," Leonardo greeted him. "I see that you came through the troubles unscathed, too," replied Ezio. "I told you, they leave me alone. They must think me either too mad, or too bad, or too dangerous to touch. But do have some wine, and there are some cakes somewhere, if they haven't gone stale. My housekeeper's useless. And tell me what's on your mind."
"I'm leaving Florence."
"So soon? But they tell me you're the hero of the hour. Why not sit back and enjoy it?"
"I have no time. Still got enemies to pursue?"
"How do you know?"
Leonardo smiled.
"Thank you for coming to say goodbye," he said.
"Before I go," said Ezio, "I have another page of the Codex for you."
"That is indeed good news. May I see it?"
"Of course."
Leonardo perused the new document carefully. "I'm beginning to get the hang of this," he said. "I still can't quite see what the general diagram in the background is, but the writing is becoming familiar. It looks like the description of another weapon."
He rose and brought a handful of old and fragile-looking books to the table.
"Let's see. I must say, whoever the inventor was who wrote all this, he must have been a very long way ahead of his time. The mechanics alone..."
He trailed off, lost in thought.
"Aha! I see.
Ezio, it's a design for another blade. One that will fit into the mechanism you attach to your arm if you need to use this one in place of the first.
What's the difference?
If I'm right, this one's quite nasty. It's hollow in the middle, see? And through the tube concealed in the blade, its user can inject poison into his victim. Death, wherever you strike. This thing would make you practically invincible.
Can you make it?
On the same terms as before?
Of course.
Good. How long have I got?
The end of the week. I have some preparations to make, and there's someone I want to try to see, to say goodbye. But I need to get going as soon as possible.
It doesn't give me long, but I still have the tools I needed for the first job, and my assistants have got their hand in, so I don't see why not.
Ezio used the intervening time to settle his affairs in Florence, pack his bags, and arrange a courier to take a letter to Monteriggioni. He found himself putting off his final, self-imposed task again and again, but he knew he'd have to do it. At last, on his second-to-last evening, he walked over to the Carfucci mansion. His feet were like lead. But when he approached the place, he found it dark and closed up. Knowing he was behaving like a madman, he clambered up to Christina's balcony, only to find her windows securely shuttered. The nasturtiums in pots on the balcony were withered and dead. As he climbed down again, wearily, he felt as if his heart had been covered in a shroud. He remained at the door in a dream for he knew not how long, but someone must have been watching him, for finally a first-floor window opened, and a woman put her head out.
"They've gone, you know. Signor Carfucci saw the trouble coming and cleared the family out to Lucca. That's where his daughter's fiancé comes from."
"Lucca?"
"Yes. The families have got quite close, I hear."
"When will they be back?"
"No idea."
The woman looked at him.
"Don't I know you from somewhere?"
"I don't think so," said Ezio. He spent that night dreaming alternately of Christina and of Francesco's bloody end. In the morning it was overcast, a sky to suit Ezio's mood. He made his way to Leonardo's workshop, glad that this was the day on which he would leave Florence. The new knife blade was ready, finished in dull grey steel, very hard, the edges sharp enough to sever a silk handkerchief if you just let it fall through the air onto them. The hole in the point was tiny.
"The hilt contains the poison, and you release it simply by flexing your arm muscle against this inner button. Be careful, as it's quite sensitive."
"What poison should I use?"
"I've used a strong distillation of hemlock to get you started, but when you run out, ask any doctor."
"Poison? From a doctor?"